Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard on Utah Public Radio around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, the massacre in Mexico of nine people with family ties to Utah, some updated election tallies for various seats, and what Salt Lake City's next mayor is planning, and more. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce, and good morning and welcome to you, Dave.
Hello.
Also, reporter Taylor Stevens is in studio. Good morning and welcome to you as well, Taylor.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke, welcome and good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Listeners, you can join us with your questions, comments, and more at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And we will begin today, David Noyce, nine people killed in northern Mexico who were U.S. citizens with Utah ties, three mothers and six children. They were killed, we believe, by members of a cartel, a drug cartel. As far as we know, Dave, what happened here?
That's what we know for the most part. There's warring drug cartels down there, sort of turf wars going on. And these people live in mainly in a place called La Mora, Mexico, a small community of about 800, 900 people maybe. A lot of them are U.S.-Mexican citizens. They were traveling in a very small caravan, three vehicles, north to Phoenix. They often go between the two places to meet up with family and such. In this case, at least one of the family members were going to Phoenix to pick up one of the women was going to pick up her husband, who had been working in the North Dakota oil fields,
right,
and for a wedding anniversary. And they were ambushed killed in kind of like two separate attacks. They were kind of, you know, a little bit of apart. But yeah.
Do we know why they were targeted?
I guess that's one of the questions is, were they targeted? Many of the people down there do feel like they were targeted. Others feel like they were in these SUVs where it was a mistaken identity, although that seems less likely now, possibly, because the women certainly, according to all accounts, showed themselves, you know, and so I think they could see that it probably wasn't that.
So so either mistaken identity, meaning that they were mistaken for a rival.
Exactly, some kind of rival drug peddlers or something like that. But it's looking more like it might be that way. At least that's what the people in the community feel.
You mentioned, you know, three mothers, a number of children. One of the mothers killed Donna Langford. She was one of 48 siblings. She was remembered as a kind of trickster. Maria Ronita Miller died with four of her children. She was going to pick up her husband, as you said, who had been working in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And then Christina Marie Langford Johnson, she was traveling with her seven-month-old daughter, Faith. Faith was one of the survivors of this attack, right?
Yes, it appears that her mother, when their vehicle came under attack, took the baby and placed it on the floor to, I guess, shield it as best she could. And the baby was then found later, yes.
There were other survivors, children as well. Reporting on this by Tribune, reporter Nate Carlisle talks about a 13-year-old survivor hiding some of the other surviving children and then walking.
Right.
13 or 14 miles to
correct to get help. We'd love to talk to that young man. There were at least five other kids wounded, and some of them in hospitals in Arizona. Some have been released. One of them was at one of the funerals yesterday. This boy apparently took the other kids with him and hid them in the bushes and put branches over them, kind of conceal them as best they could, not knowing if these marauders were going to come back at all, and then hiked back to the community to try to get help and notify get help. Pretty amazing.
Wow. You know, we mentioned the Utah ties. There's a caravan of people who went down from Utah to attend the funerals of a number of these victims. Can you lay out the Utah ties for us? How is that connection there?
It has roots in a lot of different things, and it's not just Utah. It's sort of states around the West a little bit. It has its roots sort of in Mormon polygamy a little bit. That's how this community came to be. I don't know if you want me to go into all of that a little bit, but
so I mean the history there is people going to Mexico after Utah or after the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints outlaws polygamy or bans.
Sort of. I mean, some communities started before when the LDS Church still practiced polygamy, but it was starting to on the outs and go away as a condition of statehood. The church, LDS Church, the mainstream church, disavowed polygamy officially in 1890. But some members actually went down there to try to dodge the U.S. law that prevented polygamy. This community, many of the people, the roots in this community came later.
Okay.
They were people who, after the church, LDS Church had abandoned polygamy in the early 1900s when it was pretty much gone in the mainstream church. They wanted to continue to practice it. Went down there and established community, yeah.
You know, I noticed that national and international coverage even has been referring sort of generically to the victims and these families as Mormons. Did the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, weigh in on what happened here?
Well, it's a tricky area for them a little bit. They want to emphasize... They want to show, of course, compassion, like anybody would in a tragedy like this, but they want to make sure that there's no confusion. And they actually checked the membership records and found out none of these people were members of the mainstream Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But Mormonism has a broad rubric, you know. It covers a lot of different faith traditions that have traced their roots to Mormonism.
As a label, I mean.
As a label. So it's, you know, it's not... exactly wrong, of course, to call them Mormons, at least in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of history there, and I want to get to the funeral services that Nate Carlisle covered as well. There were there's kind of, as we said, a convoy from Utah and elsewhere in the U.S. that went down there. Nate's reporting on these funerals has been, you know, heart-wrenching. It's burials taking place in these communities, funerals at the homes of the victims themselves, right?
Mm-hmm. And more than 500 people were at one of the funerals for LaDonna or Donna yesterday. And like I say, they came from all over. People started arriving. Nate Carlisle, our reporter, and our photographer Trent Nelson traveled with this community down there. They went down under guard of Mexican police and military, trying to assure their safe passage through that same area. And when people arrived in the community, they had basically a community welcome kind of dinner for everyone. They laid out food for all the people, and they did the same thing at the end of the funerals yesterday.
Is the family, you know, I mean, this is their home. It's been their home for 100 years or more. And the families, the victims of this mm-hmm. this attack, how are they feeling in terms of safety? I know there's been a lot of critique of security in Mexico, basically.
I mean, they've been living in this area for a while and trying to navigate the drug cartels down there. A lot of reports say that they had been warned by the drug cartels not to ever travel that road at night, and they tried to make sure they never did that. This attack and these ambushes happened in broad daylight, of course. So that safety it looks like it's fairly tenuous now. There was a lot of anger yesterday at the funeral, especially from David Langford, husband, and basically saying we're defenseless here. The Mexican government and the military have not protected us, and because of, I mean, he even went off about gun laws, the fact that
right.
he didn't feel like they could protect themselves. We're planning to do more stories on that whole aspect of it. They feel pretty angry and abandoned right now, that they're out there in this remote mountainous area and they're kind of on their own.
Have there been? Arrests made? You know, are there any suspects in this attack?
Well, there was an arrest made a couple days ago that looked like it was originally reported was tied to the group in the ambush, but then was later dismissed as that wasn't the case. So I think everyone's waiting for that. Of course, Mexican president and security chief for the country have vowed that they're going to find the perpetrators of this, but they haven't had much success for a long time in trying to rein in that problem.
President Trump even weighed in on that as well.
Offered U.S. assistance that will help and catch, quote, these monsters. Mexican government politely refused, I suppose, that offer. Of course, worried about their own sovereignty and independence. This has been something that's been exasperating. It sounds like it's getting worse, and a lot of people are starting to talk about Mexico teetering on the brink of being a failed state.
Robert Gerke, I want to bring you in on this, a news columnist from the Salt Lake Tribune. And, you know, Mexico, as Dave points out, has had its fair share of violence from drug wars. I mean, this isn't even the deadliest narco attack in recent months. Last month, 14 people killed in Michoacán. That's 14 police officers, actually. 15 people killed in another attack in the state of Guerrero last month. This murder is different. It's mothers, it's young children, but it's also U.S. citizens or people who have dual U.S.-Mexico citizenship. Bringing a spotlight on this, I guess, what's your take on that sort of concept of there being a heightened amount of violence occurring in Mexico?
Yeah.
The impact here?
I mean, like, you hit the nail on the head, I think. It's a violent area. The drug gangs are running the show in a lot of ways, and what I'm kind of interested in is going forward, are these communities sustainable down there? Do they stay down there, or do they look to move elsewhere, someplace safer after this tragedy? I mean, you can't call it anything but a tragedy. It's horrible, and the stories you told about the young people helping each other, it's hard to fathom, hard to put yourself in that situation and imagine the fear that they must have had. It's horrible. The Mexican government has struggled with trying to get its hands around this issue for years and years, and obviously based on the fact that things like this still happen, haven't done a very good job of it.
Well, and it's hard not to point to the reason for the violence being the market for cocaine and other illicit drugs here in the United States. I know that the relatively new president of Mexico has kind of taken a hands-off approach, that he's not going, choosing not to do constant battle with the cartels in Mexico as a strategy. Just on a point that Robert Gerke made, David Noyce, are these communities, it's early days, but are they considering something like relocating?
That's cross. They're saying things like that. Here's the problem. These are successful communities. They have farms that work. They farm pecans, chiles, all kinds of different. They have businesses. They have ranches there. They're there because they love the beauty of the place they are. I mean, you hear a lot of people in Utah talk that way. I love where I'm at, where I'm living here in this rugged area. And they have successful farms and operations there. Sometimes right now they're in a season where they're harvesting some things. They can't just up and leave, and they've been there for generations. So it'd be hard. However, there are people talking about should we go someplace else safe, and how do we do that?
Well, this is a question that I think matters in that context is, are they still practicing polygamists or can they go somewhere? And, they fled the ban on polygamy
Right.
Or legal ban on polygamy.
One thing about this is most of the people there, at least from Nate's reporting, are not actually practicing polygamists. However, most of them believe in that principle, that practice, so they're supportive of that. But they're not actually practicing polygamous anymore, and they don't really belong to a certain sect or church. They're not like people. When we think of polygamists, we think of certain groups like the FLDS or the Apostolic United Brethren. They don't really belong to any of these sects. They're sort of self-practicing, I guess you could say, polygamous, but obviously with a lot of deep ties in Mormonism. Some of the speeches given yesterday and the sermons given and eulogies, you could hear a lot of Mormon scripture quoted. So they have their roots there.
Hmm. David Noyce, there's probably a great deal more to the story that we could talk about. Nate Carlisle's reporting is pretty spectacular, so check that out at sltrip.com. Do you have any final comments before we
Well, you know, I would also urge people to go look at some of the photos that Trent Nelson took. I mean, it's very, very riveting and very sad. It's the only way you can say it is sad and sorry. I talked with Nate last night to see how he was holding up, because it's not easy to cover back-to-back funerals like that,
right,
involved like this, and it's difficult. And I'd urge people to look at those and kind of get a sense of what that community is going through.
It's some remarkable photographs. Again, a tragic story out of northern Mexico, and that's Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce. We're going to take a quick break in the show, and up next we will turn to election results. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce, reporter Taylor Stevens, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. We are at KCPW. Let's turn now to election results from Tuesday's various municipal elections. And Taylor Stevens, a big contest here was the Salt Lake City mayor's race. That race, unlike several other races that we'll talk about shortly, is final. We know who the winner is, right?
That's right. So Salt Lake City Councilwoman Erin Mendenhall will become Mayor Mendenhall in January.
Okay. And why did this race, you know, end earlier than others?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been covering this race for 13 months and not really sure how, obviously, things are going to turn out on election night. There was some polling that showed Erin with a substantial lead, others that showed kind of within the margin of error. However, on election night, Mendenhall's lead was quite a bit wider, I think, than even her campaign expected. She had a lead of more than 5,800 votes. Neither candidate was really willing to call it on election night. State Senator Luz Escamilla wanted to wait and see when all of the ballots were counted because you have no idea how many outstanding ballots there are at that point. And Mendenhall also wanted to, you know, kind of see what happened. But on Wednesday, when it became clear that there were less than 10,000 ballots left to be counted, Senator Escamilla did concede to Mendenhall. And the next day, so yesterday, Mendenhall had her first press conference as mayor-elect, in which she outlined how she plans to transition from councilwoman to mayor. So a lot has happened in the last few days on this front.
I want to get to that press conference in just a bit, but I think I actually want to bring in the news columnist here in studio, Robert Gerke, because you dug through the detailed breakdown of how this vote played out across Salt Lake City. And you wrote about it in your column. What did you find in terms of where this race was won for Mendenhall or maybe lost for Escamilla?
Yeah, I mean, I think the narrative of this campaign, this election throughout, has been that Luz Escamilla would try to energize the west side of Salt Lake City that often doesn't get the attention that it deserves, and get people from the west side to come out and turn out and support her. And it worked for her in the primary, but I'll tell you, Erin, she still lost the west side. Luz won the west side 57-43. Those west side precincts, everything west of I-15. But 57-43 is a lot better than Erin did in the primary. And so I think by limiting her losses there, it gave her the ability to really dominate east of I-15. For example, just some. Yeah. There's 24 precincts west of I-15. Luz won 20 of them, but she only won 4 precincts east of I-15. And there's a lot more people east of I-15 than there are west. And so that's why you see those big results. I mean, I think the other thing that you've got to give the Mendenhall campaign a lot of credit because, as Taylor mentioned, the polling was looking like it was going to be, you know, probably Erin winning, but not by much. All of the, you know, you saw a big movement by the undecided voters at the end in her direction. And we saw the same thing in the primary. She was polling third, but going into the primary and she finished first. All of the late movement went in her direction. And that's also a credit of to her ability to get out her supporters in a low turnout election like these municipal elections always are. Getting your supporters to the polls is crucial, and I think she did a much better job of that than the Escamilla campaign did.
I mean, there's often a lot of talk about ground game, you know, people getting out there and right knocking on doors and mobilizing the people who have expressed support for them. But was this race, you know, won on any particular policy position or stance, Robert Gehrke? It seemed like there was a lot of similarities between the candidates.
There were a lot of similarities between the two candidates. Their stances on Inland Port, for example, weren't all that far off. I mean, I think it kind of, people I spoke to anecdotally kind of said, well, they felt like Mendenhall, coming from the city, knew the city issues better than Escamilla did and would be better able to deliver on the promises she was making.
Taylor Stevens, is that what you saw in your reporting, you know, going out and talking to people, that, you know, first off, that there wasn't a lot of daylight between the two candidates, but people broke for Aaron on that particular idea?
Yeah, as someone who's written more than 50 stories on this race and gone to dozens of debates, I disagree that they were similar. I think they had very different backgrounds and different sort of ways of approaching the job, even if on a lot of the issues they had similar stances. Mm-hmm. I do think that Mendenhall was trying to sort of position herself as the person, as Gehrke said, who could come in day one, have the experience and knowledge of City Hall to really get some outcomes. Whereas, you know, with Escamilla, she could kind of make that argument that you are getting four more years of the same. We've been run by former state legislators in the past. We don't have a good relationship with the state. So I think that was, you know, one of the tensions, whereas Luz Escamilla talked about her administrative experience, her years in public service. So I think they both kind of had different experiences they were bringing to the table, and it appears that residents were ready for someone with City Hall experience based on their votes.
You know, you talked about the sheer volume of reporting you've done on this and also the number of debates you covered and so on. I just have to ask, are you glad the season's over?
It's just beginning. Now we have a new administration to cover, and we'll be, you know, watching to see what comes of the promises made during the debates. So we're not going away by any means.
Well, you talked about Mendenhall holding this event yesterday on the steps of the city and county building. She was laying out her sort of plans, I guess, for when she becomes mayor, for when she takes when she takes the oath of office. Part of those plans include sitting down with Senator Escamilla, right?
Yeah, she plans to sit down with both Escamilla and this is separately, but also with Mayor Jackie Biskupski. They've had sort of a tenuous relationship in the past, as the mayor and council kind of as a whole have had. The mayor has promised to work to make this as smooth of a transition as possible, and Aaron kind of outlined some of the ways that she wants to do that. For example, she says that she will not be requesting blanket resignations from department and division heads as Biskupski came under some controversy early in her administration for doing. She also plans to begin holding office hours at city libraries across the city the day after the canvass, so that she can sort of start working towards getting some guidance documents in place that they can begin implementing some of the wishes of residents, community councils, business leaders, etc.
And there, you know, actually, just on the sort of tension between the current mayor and the future mayor. In the campaign, there wasn't a lot of, well, maybe you can tell me this. Was there much in the way of going negative between Senator Escamilla and Aaron Mendenhall, you know, against each other kind of fight? And what I'm pointing at is that the fact that there was some negativity between Mendenhall and Biskupski during the campaign. But did we see much of that between Mendenhall and Escamilla during the campaign?
I think most of the people I've talked to see this as a much cleaner race than we've had in the past. Both candidates sort of pledged to focus on the issues. I think they did that for the most part. You know, there were some spats specifically on the Inland Port and, you know, Luz and Aaron kind of going back and forth on their respective records on that issue, as well as billboards came into play a little bit with the Mendenhall campaign criticizing Escamilla's campaign for taking billboard donations. So it's not like they never took a swing at each other, but at the same time, it was very civil. And in the aftermath of the campaign, both candidates have wished each other well and been very complimentary to one another. So I think it was cleaner than we've seen in the past.
I think, if I could just jump in, I think, you know, Senator, it's, there wasn't anything on the surface. You know, the campaigns didn't attack each other. There weren't. I was surprised that there weren't more PACs getting involved. We saw even in the primary some PACs sending out mailers attacking candidates or supporting candidates. And so I was a little surprised we didn't see more of that. The Senator Escamilla did kind of point to what she called whisper campaigns about her religion that she said started in the primary and went through. We saw Rocky Anderson wade into that publicly.
And that wasn't a whisper.
That was not a whisper campaign. And then there was also some whisper campaigns at the end about ethics allegations against Councilwoman Mendenhall. But aside from those things, I think it was a pretty well-fought race.
Taylor Stevens, you, in addition to, you know, some of the plans that she laid out and who she's going to meet with, Mayor-elect Mendenhall also announced a transition team. Who's on that team?
So she will have two co-chairs on her transition committee, Marcia Garcias, who is currently the executive director of NeighborWorks Salt Lake City, and Natalie Gochner, the director of the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute at the U, Rachel Otto, the director of government relations at the Utah League of Cities and Towns, is going to leave her position there to serve as chief of staff for the transition.
Okay.
I think the Rachel Otto pick is a really interesting one because she is a policy person. She comes from the League's her background is at the League, and she's worked a lot extensively at the legislature. And I think that tells you that Erin is trying to stay out of some of the political infighting that often occurs in City Hall and bring somebody in who's more of an outsider who has a fresh eyes on the city and is also able to work with the state legislature. And I think that was a great pick.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist, gets to opine whenever he wants to. I think maybe we should turn to some other election news and stay close to home to begin with. There were, city council races, and two of the three incumbents who were running basically have won their seats. Ana Valdemoros, who was chosen by the council to replace Derek Kitchen when he went to the state Senate to replace Senator Jim DeBacchus. and then also Andrew Johnston in District 2 won his seat, or they appear to have won their seats. The District 6 race is another story. This is a very tight race involving the Salt Lake, the council chairman, Charlie Liu. Can you tell us about that,
yeah,
Taylor?
Yeah, this is an interesting race. Not one I think anyone who's been watching expected to be close based on the outcome of the primary, in which Charlie Liu had a lead of 865 votes. But on Tuesday night, the first round of ballots came in at 8 p.m. and it showed Charlie just ever so slightly ahead. And then when the next round came in, Dan Dugan, his opponent, that had flipped and he was ahead. So the night ended with a 5-vote lead for Dan Dugan, and just kind of waiting to see what happened with that. Yesterday, we got some new ballots in and we see that Dan Dugan, who is a former Navy pilot who works in the manufacturing industry, has widened his lead. He now has 152 votes ahead. However, he did not declare victory yesterday, still waiting for a few more ballots to come in. And Charlie Liu didn't concede, so that race still, I wouldn't say, is finished.
Pending. Do you know how many ballots are left in that particular race? Do we have any idea?
We don't know yet, no.
Okay. You said Dan Dugan is a former Navy pilot. Why did he get into this race?
So he's a political newcomer, never run for public office before. For him, one of the issues that really kind of got him into the race, and it's interesting because he, you know, isn't in a West Side district, but the inland port, he feels that is going to decrease air quality, is going to cost city residents a lot of money with the loss of taxing increment there. So that was something that really got him into the race, and he talked throughout the race. He sort of criticized Charlie Liu for taking some money from Stephen Price, a developer who is sort of associated with the Inland Port project. Charlie Liu, just to be fair to him, says that those donations don't make any difference with his votes, that Stephen Price is a longtime friend. But, you know, that just kind of gives you a sense of some of the back and forth in this race. And it's interesting to see the outcome of this. I don't think anyone expected. Charlie raised 2 times as much money. Isn't everything, but
I mean, we always talk about money winning elections, and in this case, that might not be bear out. We'll see what happens with the rest of the votes. Was the issue of the inland port, other than those donations, you know, was that a vulnerability for Charlie Liu?
I think maybe Gerkey could talk about that a little bit more. Yeah. He explored that in his column.
I mean, it is and it isn't, obviously, right? I mean, because it didn't seem to hurt the other two council members. Aaron Mendenhall won Charlie's District 6, 65-35. So the other council members didn't pay a price. I think part of what the difference was is Charlie was a two-term incumbent looking for a third term. That's always dicey for in city politics. We saw it, for example, with Mayor Becker. He was a two-term incumbent looking for a third. And people were ready for a change. And Dugan offered them a change. And you really saw Dugan's momentum take off after the primary, because as you mentioned, I looked at some of the precinct level stuff, and you would expect that the primary was a 3-person race with Luke Dugan and JT Martin. JT Martin dropped out. You'd expect his supporters to go to Dugan, but Dugan still made significant inroads in large swaths of District 6, and in one district in particular, gained almost 40%. Did a 40-point flip, just turning districts that Charlie won 2-1, go completely the other way.
From the primary to
the general. And so there was, so I think what it shows is that Luke's support coming out of the primary was probably soft and easily swayed, and Dugan worked and had a message that I think turned these voters in the right direction. I will say there are ballots still outstanding. I think this is not going to go well for Charlie because, as Taylor mentioned, the first tranche of ballots were in Luke's favor. The second one was in Dugan's favor. The third one was even more in Dugan's favor. I think the fourth one will be even more in Dugan's favor, and that margin is just going to widen. Taylor, I could be wrong.
When will we know, Taylor?
We'll have another round of ballots in today at 3 p.m., and then we'll be waiting to hear from the county clerk as to whether that represents everything she mentioned. If not all the ballots got in by Friday, she would be releasing some next week. The final canvass isn't for 2 weeks, and that's when all results will be final. However, you will see candidates start to concede or declare victory when they realize that there's no way they can kind of come back from the votes that are currently in play.
Depending upon how the math breaks down. There's a little bit more from elections that I'd like to turn to, but for the moment, we need to head to another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerkey. And this is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. And Taylor Stevens, you know, we left off talking about the District 6 race. I'm wondering, kind of in the interest of time, if you wouldn't mind doing a quick rundown of some other races and how they have played out. Are there any other, you know, sort of nail biters that are akin to the District 6 race that we're waiting on?
Yeah, I'll just quickly run through a few mayoral races that we've been watching. Mill Creek and Ogden's incumbent mayors both appear to be pretty safe. In West Jordan, however, a councilman has sort of widened his lead against the incumbent there, Mayor Jim Writing. The incumbent, I should say, hasn't conceded in that race, so that's one that we'll continue to watch. Mm-hmm. Also in Brighton, there has been a victory candidate, Dan Nope, who had a 13-vote lead over Don Despain, has won, and we know that Brighton is Utah's newest town, pretty small population there, so that 13-vote lead appears insurmountable at this point.
That was pitting two sort of restaurant owners or two owners of well-known businesses,
right,
in Brighton against each other.
Exactly. Okay. So we'll continue to watch some of these races where we don't have conclusions on them, but it really goes to show that every vote counts, especially in some of these local races.
I want to turn, Robert Gerkey, I don't know if you can tackle this or not, but there's a contest that is much further afield, and this was an initiative to consider changing the form of government in San Juan County. This is a county where districts were redrawn by court order after a judge said that they were drawn in a racially discriminatory way. And that led to Navajos taking control of the county commission. What's going on with the initiative that basically, well, tell us what it does.
Well, so partly it would appear as a backlash against the two Navajo council members being elected last time. There's been an effort, a proposition to study changing the form of government for San Juan County. It doesn't recommend a specific form of government, but recommends a study to look at it. Most likely, you would see proposals to go to a five-member commission instead of a three-member, five-member council instead of a three-member commission. They might look at having a mayor-council form of government. That seems unlikely. And the thinking is that given the demographics of San Juan County, this is the advocates, given the demographics of San Juan County, drawing it into three districts is kind of hard, and maybe if you do five districts, you might have better representation, more reflective of the community. The opposing side thinks it's another effort to try to disenfranchise the Navajos, who finally have taken control of the county that they're a majority of the population in. And so right now, it looks like that the proposition is trailing a little bit, but there are still votes to be counted, as there are in all of these races. So we could know possibly today, if not early next week, how this one's going to shake out.
And this has divided San Juan County pretty sharply in terms of
it has. There were some allegations of electioneering, illegal campaigning near the polling places that was done allegedly in collaboration with the county officials that are not the Navajo officials, the white county officials down there. It's a divided county, and so when you have a group of voters trying to take or perceived to be trying to take power away from a group of voters who have just taken it back after decades and decades, it's a tense situation. And the supporters of this proposition are largely the people who have been in power in San Juan County for generations and are now for the first time experiencing being on the other side of that. And so the motivation looks bad if it's not
it looks like cause and effect that Navajos took control of the commission and now they say we want to change it so that we can get that control back. But the sponsor of this resolution or of the measure, which would consider studying changing the form of government, says that's not the case. I've been wanting to do this for a long time.
Yeah, and there's something to be said. There's merit to it, frankly. I mean, a three-member council is hard to operate, and a five-member kind of works better in a lot of ways. Just for a simple example, when you have three-member councils and two of them run into each other in the hallway, do you have an open meeting?
That's a quorum.
Yeah, it's a quorum of the council. And there's also something to be said about this isn't so much an issue in San Juan County because the population is very, very small. But when you have more members on the council, they have fewer constituents and can be more closely in contact with their constituency and the specific issues that their constituents address. Now, San Juan County is small enough that three is probably fine. But and hanging over all of this is this other proposal that's been out there for a while, and that's splitting the county and just dividing it, north and south, and letting the Navajos have their own county, letting the Anglos have their own county. There's a lot of problems with that, but it's a issue that arose during the last legislative session. I'm sure we'll be back this legislative session. The state representative from the area, Phil Lyman, is a former commissioner who is supportive of this idea. And, let's just say the shifting political dynamics in San Juan County are not going over well with all of the members of the county.
Okay. A 121 vote spread on this measure that would have looked into changing the form of county government there. And maybe 700 ballots remaining to be counted, apparently, from what I last saw.
Yeah, I mean, 121 vote spread in a county this small with as few voters as there are is a sizable advantage, but we do need to wait and see how the rest of these go.
Okay. And we'll find out when that gets decided, and you'll hear it here on KCPW. You can also check out sltrib.com. We're kind of low on time, and I wanted to get to one more item just to seek some responses from Salt Lake Tribune staffers here in front of me on the news that you, as a newspaper, are now a nonprofit organization. The IRS granted the request of the paper to become a nonprofit. It's the first legacy newspaper in the United States to do this. And basically, David Noyce, you're the managing editor there. You stay the same paper with the exception of candidate endorsements, which have already gone away. But aren't you remaining the same entity doing the same jobs?
Yeah, and I've been here 35 years doing it. Yes, and that was one of the things that was surprising, not only the fact that the IRS granted the nonprofit so quickly, but that really no other strings were attached. We knew endorsements were going to go away, but there were questions about other areas of coverage, you know, arts, things like religion, anything, what kind of strings would be put on, would be placed on that. And so we will essentially be the same, except for the endorsements. And I think a lot of people, at least on the news side, are glad to see that happening, that the endorsements are going away. But so we're looking, we're eager, and it's for the first time in at least a decade, there's hope in the newsroom that I can sense.
I was going to say, are you, you know, is it a cause for hope? Are you excited, mm-hmm. optimistic? Are you terrified? What's the response from the newsroom? But if there's hope in the newsroom, that's good. Taylor Stevens, reporter, does this mean anything at all for your job? Do you just, you know, does this affect you in any way?
To be determined.
You're not certain. I mean, in terms of the job you do, though, you're still going to go out and report and report on hopefully the same stuff you've always been reporting on.
Yeah, as far as I've been told, my job hasn't changed at all. I count myself among the people who are glad to see the editorials go away, just because I do worry that people don't always understand the difference between the Tribune speaking as an opinion and kind of the Tribune reporters doing news coverage.
And it's just to clarify, it is not all editorials are going away, just
endorsements.
Right.
Just candidate endorsements.
Yes. Candidate endorsements. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the IRS is they're sticklers about you can't use nonprofits for political purposes to advance specific candidates. So we could, you know, George and the editorial staff and I can still talk about issues, but we can't advance particular candidates.
Gerke, otherwise, your thoughts on the paper that you work for making this transition?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it can be a bad thing, right? I mean, it will open up some revenue streams from foundations and other nonprofits, and also give subscribers and supporters an avenue for them to be able to, you know, help support the reporting that the Trib does. You know, when they throw in a couple more dollars with their annual with their subscription payment, and you know, we're happy to take it. So I don't think it can be a bad thing.
Another revenue stream for the
Trib. Just a little bit more revenue stream, where it means we'll be doing
pledge drives
and that sort of thing. You know, you can get your tote bag and mugs, and no, I think it's a good thing, and I suspect we'll see other papers around the country following it.
I'll mention that on the KCPW show In the Hive, we examined this transition. I spoke with Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Tribune, and with Joshua Benton, founder of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University, about nonprofit newspapers and the future of news. You can check that out at kcpw.org. Taylor Stevens, I want to squeeze in one more story that you covered this week before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, and it was the opening of the final homeless resource center here in Salt Lake County that... you know, there were three that were slated to open. It's part of a big transition away from the old model to a new model of homelessness service provision in this area. Can you tell us when it opened? And I know that there's also been some protests over the closure of the road home that is pending.
Yeah, so that facility is not currently serving clients at this moment. However, okay. Staff have begun moving in.
A ribbon cutting.
Right, on Tuesday. So along with Election Day, we also had that to try and cover. But as you mentioned, there has been some protests over concerns about capacity, whether these three new shelters, which have space for 400 fewer people, are going to be able to handle the number of people who will be seeking shelter as the days grow colder. And what the state and partners in this transition have been working on is getting people into housing. We got a bit of an update on that yesterday, and landlords, it appears, have been stepping up, so we'll see how that plays out. As far as when clients will begin moving into the South Salt Lake shelter, that should be happening mid-month. And this sort of marks the transition and sort of the beginning of the end for the road home, the emergency shelter in the Rio Grande neighborhood that's slated to close.
And that's because of some decisions that are launched once the opening of this other shelter happens, correct?
So what it is that the shelter is slated to close 30 days after an occupancy permit has been issued. However, I think it's worth noting that The closure of the road home has been pushed back several times. It was originally slated to close this summer and has been pushed back for reasons varying from financial challenges to rainy weather.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist, thoughts on, you know, the fact that we are making this transition. We've talked about this a lot on the show.
Yeah.
And the idea is to silo people and to better help them make that transition out of homelessness and having these shelters that are resource centers as opposed to just a building to house people, which has sort of been the complaint about the previous model.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're moving to a better delivery model. My concern is that they're still moving to a better delivery model, that it's not actually in place yet. And they're hoping, there's a lot of moving pieces right now, and fortunately the weather's warmed up a little bit in the last week, but it's going to get cold again. That's a concern we have, and we've seen the mayor-elect Mendenhall is among those who suggested that the road home should stay open
through the winter.
So we have a backup, because while they're moving to this new model, they've also seen an increase in demand, and that could be, it likely is a good thing that people who otherwise would be on the streets are coming in indoors. But that also could carry through to the colder months, and we could see a higher demand than we've ever seen before with fewer beds to actually put them in. And so they're looking for other options. They've got a plan in place that relies on various pieces, including landlords, to come up with more affordable housing units. But they're kind of trying to put the car together as it's driving now. And I just worry that they don't have a backup in place if they close the road home.
And there was a protest just last night of residents calling for the road home to remain open. Taylor, you talked about it being pushed back. Do we have any sense that, you know, it could be pushed back again?
There's not much will, I don't think, political will among the people who are actually making the decisions right now. There are some advocates, and as Gerke mentioned, Mayor-elect Mendenhall, who are calling for the road home to stay open. However, most of the people who are involved in this transition believe in their plan to get people housed. They say that's the point of all of this anyway. And they do plan to reevaluate that. I think that's about in 2 weeks now that they'll reevaluate and see how everything is. However, I don't know that as it stands right now that keeping the road home open is on the table.
Yeah, just one other thing before we move on to that. There is another obvious option in place that, again, it comes down to the lack of political will by the leaders to actually do this. But they have more square footage in these units, these new resource centers, than they ever had in the road home. They could put more people in them, but then that creates pushback by the communities. The mayor of South Salt Lake, for example, is not going to be happy if they put more people than they told her they would be putting in the South Salt Lake shelter. And so, again, it comes down to a question of political will.
Taylor?
Also, just very quickly, those capacity limits are set in state law, so there would need to be some legislative action, it seems, to actually make that happen. So,
yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, it's a complicated issue and one that the Tribune will certainly be following. Right now, though, we got to move away from that and turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, where we talk about something that maybe we didn't talk about on the show today. And David Noyce, we haven't heard from you in a little while. What's your pick for underplayed story?
I had four to choose from, but I'm going to go with this one. Tony Simra had a story earlier this week about the Olympics, a subject that is popping up more and more now, basically laying out the reasons that the Olympics coming back to Utah is more of a when question than an if question. The way IOC awards bids now, once you're the representative for a nation, you're pretty much assured of getting someplace in line of doing the Olympics, of getting the Olympics. But just to show you that there's still some work to be done, a World Cup bobsled and skeleton race that was supposed to be held in at the Park City track later this month, I think it's later this month, has to move to Lake Placid because the refrigeration system is being repaired and isn't up to world-class standards yet. So even though Utah's venues are in really good shape, it does show more work is going to need to be done to bring them all up to back to world-class level consistently for the Olympics.
All right. We will see when, and I guess not if, but when Salt Lake City gets awarded another Winter Olympics. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, I want to highlight a story my colleague Courtney Tanner had on Sunday about the University of Utah's police department and its history of not treating female victims well and officers well. She has a lot of great detail in there from a series of records requests that she put in. It's definitely worth a read, particularly in light of the one-year anniversary of the killing of student-athlete Lauren McCluskey on campus there.
On campus, yeah. And that's a great pick. It was my pick for underplayed story as well. So I'm going to turn to Robert Gierke, your choice.
Okay, I echo what Taylor said. That was a fantastic story and terrific reporting. I will say in a sort of a related, unrelated story, but the University of Utah yesterday announced a new scholarship for incoming freshmen, full tuition for any incoming freshmen who have more than a 3.2. Which will significantly expand, I think, access to college educations for a lot of Utahns who might otherwise not be able to get it.
Full tuition 4 years, is that correct?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. All right. Well, that's Robert Gierke's pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. And as I said, mine was taken by Taylor. And really do check out Courtney's reporting on the University of Utah Police Department. It's really amazing and remarkable reporting. And maybe I can get her in here next week. All right. So Robert Gierke, David Noyce, and Taylor Stevens, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, for his work on the show, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan as well. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. You can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search at KCPW. Until next time, I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend.